Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is how it ends. In and around Paris, heavily armed paramilitary teams simultaneously went into action today at two hostage situations. Hostages were freed, more people were shot, and jihadists responsible for the violent attack at the Charlie Hebdo magazine were killed. This night in Paris will be an eerie, sleepless coda to a week of violence and tension. While there are no more armed fugitives believed to be at large in France right now, there is certainly the specter of radicalization haunting the night hours, and many questions for nations in Europe with sizable Muslim minorities. What are the politics of the aftermath, with the understanding that France has considerable grieving to do in the coming days? Je suis Charlie Hebdo is the chant from many quarters in France and Europe this week, expressing solidarity with the right to publish satirical cartoons, no matter their religious offense. But what other voices will be raised? We're joined now from Paris by Samuel Laurent, a French author and Middle East expert. Samuel Laurent, thanks for joining us. What are your thoughts?
Actually, you know, it's a very confusing time because obviously it's time for mourning. It's time for, thinking about people who died during these attacks. Very surprising one, very striking. Actually, we saw some at the beginning of the week. Then again, a policeman has been killed, and then today, hostage taken in a Jewish shop, in a kosher shop. So therefore, you know, everything is still confused and very messy, but obviously we can draw a couple of conclusions from now. And the first pattern that is extremely disturbing is that all the people we have, basically all the people who were involved in those attacks were known by the French intelligence services for jihadi and terrorist activities. Not one of them is, I would say, a newcomer. Some of them have been arrested, convicted of jihadi charges to channel some jihadi into the Iraq war, to fight in the insurgency against the U.S. troops at that time. And actually, some others have been trying to manage to escape some Algerian jihadi from that was imprisoned in a French jail. So basically, all of them were very well known. The second thing that is pretty disturbing is that those people that could be considered as highly dangerous, as extremely violent, extremely radicalized, none of them has been monitored closely to avoid the drama. Even more than that, one of them has been traveling to Yemen, which is basically one of the hotbed of Qaeda, and he's been traveling there on 2011. So the question everybody should ask now, that obviously those people have been neutralized for three of them, and that basically the danger is fading, is how come we had such a gap in our security, regarding also that two of them were on the no-fly list of the U.S. So does that mean the U.S. intelligence is more able to monitor the French jihadi operating in France, and that our services are so inefficient that they're able to let those people at wide, preparing operation, traveling to terrorist zone, training there, and then coming back here and plotting such terror attacks for days with heavy weapons, with rocket launchers, with AK-47s. So honestly, there is a mix between obviously sadness and mourning, as I was saying, but as well a sense of anger against what we would say is a very lax attitude of the French government towards the Islamist problem.
Samuel Laurent, you've certainly put your finger on what is likely to be the outrage in the coming days. Remind us of the special history of France in the colonial period regarding Algeria and how the models of terrorism that plagued France during that period may still be alive and well today, or at least symbols and models.
Well, France has been a friend and foe for a very long time with Algeria. We have a very complex relationship with them, obviously, because they were a colony. They were even more. They were a part of France. So this is very different from other places like Morocco, for example, which was only a protectorate. The feelings are very extreme. And in the 90s, we have saw a war over there that was basically one of the first very large-scale jihad that was leaded against the Algerian government that was at that time very close to the Soviet Union. And we have played, France has played a very ambiguous role, sheltering some opponents and basically distancing himself from the very brutal methods of the regime. But it has backlashed. We have a huge community of Algerians. We have a huge community of people from Morocco, Tunisia, and the Sahel region. And this represents about 10% of the population, 10% of Muslims, mostly from Africa or Middle East and that special part of Africa. Therefore, I would say it's a very touchy issue. We need to address the problem of radical Islam, especially nowadays that Syria and Iraq has flourished, and that community seems to be very very attracted by the ideas of radical Islam. We need to address the problem of Islam in France, but this is such a large community, such a politically sensitive community that nobody wants to basically put the debate on the table and try to address the freedom of Muslims, as well as the limit of this freedom, in terms of control, of monitoring for the most radical of them.
He's just returned from Syria, observing the jihadist consequences in that war-torn nation. Samuel Laurent is a French author and Middle East expert. He spoke with us from Paris. Thank you, Samuel.
Thank you very much.
Will the now-dead Karachi brothers become symbols in France of jihadism and radicalization? Who are these people? The two brother jihadists in Paris and at least one accomplice have changed the national consciousness in that country. We spoke with Hussein Rashid, professor of religion at Hofstra University.
I think it's very hard to come up with a general profile, but I think when we look at the Kawashi brothers, I think they represent a specific type. These were guys who lost their parents at a very young age, didn't feel like they belonged anywhere, were looking for acceptance and belonging, and they found a charismatic guy, a Charlie Manson type figure, I think we've talked about this before, who brought them into a fold and said, I love you, now go and kill for me. It's a very cultic-like atmosphere. And I think we see the same thing happening, for example, with the surviving Sarnaev brothers on trial this week in Boston, that these were young men who were lost, looking for a sense of belonging. It's typical gang initiation pattern with bigger guns and more violent ideology.
Would you say it's fueled by the difficult economy in Europe right now?
I think the economy plays a role. I don't think we can discount the ways in which there's a lack of cultural integration. And I don't think we can discount the rhetoric of the West at war with Islam that's coming out of some of these preachers and the situation in Iraq, in Syria, in Egypt. I think we have to see this as all part of a bigger complex.
You know, the free speech debate in the United States centered mostly around pornography, not about these anti-religious images. But I do recall that when the Supreme Court case of Larry Flint and Hustler made it to the Supreme Court, all of a sudden there was this need to recognize that this provocative element of free speech existed. And years after that, it's almost as though it has no fangs anymore. There's no sense of offense about Larry Flint. He's just sort of this tolerable figure out there, and there's, you know, a whole porn world that's out there. But I'm wondering if the ultimate impact of this would be to reduce the provocative nature of cartoonists like this, that that as Europe recognizes what tolerance is all about, the inflammatory nature of these kinds of images diminishes.
And I think you bring up a really good point. I am a near free speech absolutist. I think people should have the right to do or say anything as offensive as they want to, and the appropriate response is more speech. This is very much part of the American John Stuart Mill informed tradition. What I think we miss here is that just because you have the right and the ability to do something doesn't mean that you are operating in a vacuum. And I'm not talking about self-censorship here. What I'm talking about is there's certain things that we do or don't do out of respect for other people. And I think satire, I don't think any religion should be off limits, including Islam. I think satire is a perfectly legitimate tool to respond to power, to respond to stupidity. I've argued that one of the best tools we have against fighting ISIS is to mock them and to satirize them. I think what we see often, though, is that under the rhetoric of free speech and satire, we see bullying of oppressed and marginalized communities. And I think Hebdo mixed those lines.
I wonder if we resolve this bullying versus censorship thing. Zbigniew Brzezinski was on television today screaming about it's not censorship, it's common sense. It's not censorship, it's common sense. As though common sense is a shared understanding. It really isn't. It's a product of liberalism. And if you're not liberal, your common sense is different. What are we going to do about that to get a more shared experience in Europe regarding what constitutes bullying and what constitutes free speech?
And I think you have hit on the exact right set of language. When we talk about the liberal tradition, particularly the American liberal tradition, it is about individual rights and individual autonomy working for the common good. And I think what we're seeing in the French notion of the liberal tradition is individual rights and individual desires trumping the common good. So when we talk about what's happening in France is that there's no sense that their immigrants and their minorities are part of French society and need to be considered as part of the common good as well. I think the liberal tradition in its most robust and fulfilled form involves bringing different parties together to negotiate difficulties together. And I think this is really one of the issues, is that he can claim the language of the high ground but not the practice of the high ground. And I don't think it's just the responsibility of French society, right? I mean, I think the Kouachi brothers and the organizations that sponsored them don't think about the common good either. And I don't necessarily think that that's an Enlightenment concept. Muslim theological traditions have the idea of maslaha, or the common good, as well. And so even within the Muslim tradition, the Kouachi brothers are not part of that common good conversation. So.
Well, then let's put it back on Charlie Hebdo. What do they do? What purpose do they serve? This Michel Houellebecq, whose book is now published in France and will get much more attention than it ever got, you know, otherwise. The idea of Sharia law as a horrible, you know, toxin in humanity. He's making this point in his book. Is there a role for that?
I absolutely think so. I think there are ways to criticize. I think there are ways to question. I'm a scholar of the study of religion. What I do in my class is question a lot of these premises for Islam, for Judaism, for Christianity. That's what the role of a liberal intellectual tradition does. But there are also ways in which we present it as really being questioning and saying, what is the role of Islam in French society? Versus Muslims are going to take over and they need to be excised from the body politic and are scum. I mean, I think there's a difference, a qualitative difference in how you present that.
Hussein Rashid, professor of religion at Hofstra University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Boy, happy days are here again in the USA, huh? What are we going to do about that? Latest job data shows a 5.6% unemployment rate, the lowest in 8 years, an increase in payrolls by a slow but healthy 252,000 workers for the month of December. Is the recent 50% decline in oil prices central to the relief for consumers we're experiencing? And Capitol Hill politicians maybe don't want to disturb it, you know? If it's not broken, don't fix it. Or could it be some unexpected economic cover for raising fuel taxes right now to wisely funnel some good times into funding some much-needed maintenance of U.S. infrastructure? This is the important debate coming into focus right now in Congress. With us to talk about that and about the announced retirement of California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, we're joined by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So does Barbara Boxer want to tax our gasoline on the way out of the Senate?
Oh, she would love to. The four-term senator from California announced her retirement, and boy, is that going to be one heck of a primary and a Senate race in California. That's like a mini presidential race that going to face now in 2016. Barbara Boxer would love to raise gasoline taxes. She's never been able to do it because Republicans just say no way. But there are new proposals, John, you're right, to raise the federal gasoline tax. But here's the thing. Those proposals aren't coming from the Barbara Boxers, the tax-raising liberals of the world. No. They're coming from Republicans in the Senate, not really in the House yet, but some Republicans in the Senate are speaking up in a specific way, saying what you just said. Oil prices are low. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is dead broke and faces a future of being dead broke. We have crumbling infrastructure, and we absolutely need reform. And federal gas taxes haven't been raised since 1993. Now listen to Tennessee Republican Senator Bob Corker, who has proposed to raise the gas tax since 6 cents next year, 6 cents the year after that, and then to index it to inflation so that Congress doesn't have to keep patching it. Listen to Corker.
Look, at the end of the day, while they're talking like I am to you right now on a mic, many people, people aren't going to jump out there and say they're for a user fee. Privately, when you talk to people, and that's maybe one of the reasons that the person you alluded to hasn't said something negative, people understand this has got to be dealt with.
What was the person you were alluding to that Corker talked about there? And I noticed he didn't use tax. He used user fee in that language.
Right. And both of those things are very important. The person he was alluding to who didn't rule it out was Speaker John Boehner, who I asked about this a couple of days ago. Now, Boehner and his spokespeople have said, I'm against raising the gas tax. But he was asked specifically if it's off the table in any kind of tax reform deal. He doesn't rule it out. He has not ruled it out. And that's interesting. He could say, never going to happen. He just says, I'm against it. Now, user fee is important too, because what's interesting is some Republicans are saying, look, I think the first thing we need to do is quit calling this a tax. It's not a tax. It is a user fee you pay per gallon because you use the highways, and so do truckers, and so do cabbies, and so does anybody who drives a car or a van. And they're trying to recast it. Listen to Senator Orrin Hatch. Who's he? He's the chairman of the Finance Committee, the guy who controls tax policy in the Senate. He's the heavy hitter on this issue.
You know, I think we're going to change the rhetoric on that because, let's face it, the gas, the so-called, I would call it a user fee. I prefer not to increase taxes, but to me, that's a user fee. People who use the highways ought to pay for them. And that's a small price to pay to have the best highway system in the world. And that may be where we're going to have to go.
User fee. I feel better already about that. Aren't a lot of Americans, Republicans and Democrats, going to say that, hey, didn't we do the infrastructure thing back during the stimulus package at the beginning of the financial meltdown? Haven't we already taken care of all this?
Well, here's the thing. We did something during the stimulus and the meltdown, but for the last five goes at this, John, Congress has been patching a hole in the Federal Highway Trust Fund. It's perennially behind, so it's a deepening and deepening hole that Congress keeps shoveling money into. Now, you say they could just stop doing that, but of course, every district, every state, and every locality in America has roads and bridges. There's no way to stop spending on it. One of the things that Corker is saying that a lot of Republicans agree with is that what you need is long-term reform of this. You got to quit just patching the Highway Trust Fund. Now, a lot of Republicans, conservatives say, yes, we can reform the way the trust fund works, but we don't need to put any more money into it. And let's be honest, Bob Corker, even though John Boehner hasn't ruled it out, he's going to get a lot of pushback from conservatives in the House. And that's where tax policy is really written. Devin Nunes is from California. He's on the Ways and Means Committee. And I just kind of put it to him, hey, do you think the House could ever raise the gas tax? And he said, I don't.
Especially in California. I mean, I just know that California has the highest gas tax in the country, and you know, the last thing I want to do is raise taxes on people who are especially low income.
So Republicans want to help low income people by not raising the gas tax. Democrats are involved in that as well, and there may be something of a showdown between Boehner and his Senate colleagues.
Well, it's possible, and we don't know where this is going to go. This whole thing doesn't really come to fruition probably until the spring. But the fascinating thing about this is not only that Republicans are the ones who are proposing an increase in the federal gas tax, but they've already started throwing out ideas and debating it in a very serious way. Bob Corker says raise it 12 cents and then index it to inflation so we don't have to fight over this. Susan Collins of Maine says that's all fine, but everybody in my state has to drive. We don't have any buses in Maine. People drive 2 hours to get to work. I need some way to rebate low-income people so that they don't have to pay a disproportionate share. The point is, this is a really serious debate that's starting, and it's Republicans that are doing it, and people like Barbara Boxer, who would love to raise the gas tax if it could be her last act in the Senate, are kind of liking that conversation.
But the big headline here may be that in these sort of good times in America, the GOP has to modify its Obama is ruining the country agenda, and this is one element of that.
John, that might be part of it, but what this is really about, I think, is timing. There is a major tax reform effort in Congress coming down the pike. It might be worth $1 trillion or more, corporate tax reform. And Republicans and Democrats are spotting the opportunity. They think there's no time like now. And with gas at $50 a barrel, they think they have to move now.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Returning now to the unfolding situation in France, one of the consequences of the violent attack against the satiric magazine Charlie Hebdo will be a reassessment of France's approach to its own large Muslim community. Will this reassessment become a vigorous embrace of Muslim immigrants and the sizable Algerian population in France from colonial days, when Algeria was considered practically a part of France? Or will it confirm suspicions of terrorist radicals invading the homeland? This is a question that is being framed all across Europe this week as the attacks and Europe's response reveal a historic tension that nationalist politicians have exploited for decades. Andrea Mimone is a lecturer in European history at Royal Holloway, University of London.
The attack itself is part of a wider narrative, including the jihad, this alleged war of religion, and so on. In Europe, there are some ethnic tensions. I mean, we shouldn't forget that there has been a growth of far-right parties since the 80s, actually. Usually the public opinion got wrong, because every time there is an election, they say, well, the rise of the far-right. It's not true, because now it is a couple of decades that they are rising. I mean, there is in some countries a general, let's say, anti-immigration feeling. If you look at the UK, for example, with the UKIP, this nationalist party rising, at least according to surveys today, we see the conservative, but also the Labour, in some sense, talking more about immigration, talking more about the need to preserve some British identity, and also challenging Europe and banning eventually migrants from benefits and so on. I mean, so there is a wider framework which can explain some of these tensions, taking aside the fact that this is a brutal act which has nothing to do with politics or even ideology, at least in my view.
Andrea Mimone, would you say that France is both the largest country with a Muslim minority, a large Muslim minority, perhaps the largest in Europe, at the same time as it is a leader in the nationalist movement with the party of Marine Le Pen?
Yes, it is. But it is Europe, probably, which today is full of contrast, of contradictions, in the sense that France is also a place where, I mean, if we look at history, France is also the place of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and so on. Which, I mean, all this was at the core also of the building of the European community after the war. Also in France, there is a large part of the population which is fully integrated with, let's say, non-French native or people coming from former colonies. But at the same time, I mean, actually, we are living in a very dark period, probably, of at least Western European history, because, I mean, you're fully right. There is this movement from Marine Le Pen, which is has lots of votes. I mean, I suspect that she will get up to the presidential election passing the first ballot. So, but also her father, I mean, this is a story which I said started in the 1980s in France, because her party, the Front National, was created in the 70s, early 70s. And in the 80s, they started getting votes with Marine Le Pen father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. And Jean-Marie Le Pen was also in the French presidential election some years ago. So it is a matter of identity as well. I mean, France is a place where there is a strong feeling of identity. You know, they perceive themselves as exceptional in some ways. And they're losing part of it. They're losing part of it because of globalization, because of European integration, because of Americanization, and also because of the Germany-led Europe, which they are suffering, actually. And we need to keep in mind, this is a as you know, a very bizarre period in economic terms, because we have, for example, this economic crisis, which in Europe is not actually, Europe is not good at all economically. So there is a restriction of the job market. There are people from other, sometimes continents, sometimes other member states, EU member states, moving around and looking for jobs. And so people start looking at these parties because they are politically incorrect. They give demagogic responses like, you know, let's close our borders and so on.
Finally, Andrea, would you say that there are voices not unlike Charlie Hebdo in Italy and Britain whose notion of secularism is just as provocative, and we might see cartoons from them that are fighting back here and that might actually provoke further events?
I don't know. I don't think that in Italy there is the same there will be same type of cartoons as in France. Moreover, Italy has a stronger relationship with part of the Middle East. This is also why Italy almost never experienced terrorist attacks. In Britain, yes, it might be even more possible. But I think that the game is open now because, I mean, these people did a terrible act. And I would hope that this is actually acting against them, because the majority of European population, including, I'm sure, the Muslim one, they are against this type of acts.
Describing this very much as a turning point, Andrea Mamone is a lecturer in European history at Royal Holloway University of London. Andrea Mamone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You know, this story is really about perception versus reality. Can one veto the other? Let's give it a try. Muslim population in the United States. Your best guess? 5%? The correct answer would be 1%. In fact, it's just under. But that question has been asked in France as well. According to the polling group Ipsos Mori, an average French person thinks about 30% of its population is Muslim. The correct number is 8. In Germany, people think about a fifth of its population is Muslim. In fact, it's only 6%. In every country polled, in fact, there was a significant gap between perception and reality. We've put the stats up for you at thetakeaway.org. I'm sure you'll be interested. And here's what you're talking about.
This is Kristen calling from Londonderry, New Hampshire. I've never read Charlie Hebdo, and I'm willing to bet that most of the people listening to the program haven't either. Until we know really what the content of the magazine was, I think it's dangerous to make assumptions about people's motivations based on hearsay.
Jean from New York says, should verbal bullying in the classroom, on the playground, in the workplace, etc., be part of the discussion on free speech? Does it matter whether our comments are directed at individuals or groups?
This is Carolyn from King of Prussia, and I don't believe that anyone has the right to use violence to prohibit the thinking, the expression of other people. It's completely wrong. That's the golden rule.
The only golden rule is you call 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org. We've talked a lot this week about the piano as a piece of furniture, as a lost and found love, and as the vessel for centuries of spectacular music. But we haven't tackled the question of, does the piano rock? Here to settle that question is the legendary rocker Ben Folds. He can play Jimi Hendrix on the piano, along with his own distinctive songs made famous by the Ben Folds Five Band. And he's thought of the piano as a rock and roll instrument from the moment he faced his first keyboard.
At the piano, I'm mostly self-taught. Yeah, I mean, my discipline was percussion, drums, and I did have some lessons on the piano, but I didn't really have a piano teacher, not anyone that I thought really taught me a lot. But I had music teachers, you know, band teachers, percussion teachers, and orchestra directors. And that's where I got my formal training.
Where did you have access to pianos? I mean, I guess they're everywhere. Was there one in your house growing up?
There wasn't for some time. And then when I was 9, my father brought one in one night because he's in construction, and they had remodeled a house. The owner didn't have the money to pay the full amount, so they said, we'll give you some furniture and a piano. So
that's so great.
Yes, he brought in an old Acrosonic console piano, and I started playing that. There was one at school I could get my hands on every once in a while, too. Pianos were more common. That was the thing people had in their living rooms back then.
And they started to move them out of the living rooms and into your domain to some extent. I mean, when I was growing up, the piano was like the tiptoe around it kind of piece of furniture, and we don't bang on the piano. But I suspect that you have a different set of rules as a percussionist playing the piano. If I was a piano that you were playing, would I feel like I was getting a massage, or maybe feel a little bit more like I was in a prison camp in North Korea?
Well, you know, you pianos are pretty tough, so... I guess, you know, if you can compare it to a massage, I mean, there's that really horrible shiatsu massage, which some people are okay with, and others, like me, it hurts. So, I mean, I think pianos can take it. If you hit a guitar like that, it'd be broken in the first note, because a guitar can't take that. Like, if you watch a guitar player, the physicality of it is very, very subtle. It's the rock god instrument, but it takes just very, very little effort. It's something that it requires a little bit of theatrics to make it look like it's physical at all. But when it comes to piano, the harder you play the piano, most pianos will respond by being prettier and prettier, brighter, chimier. They don't get aggressive. So all your aggressive energy goes into something that comes out fairly tame.
I've seen that, you know, in your concerts. And just to hear you say that, it really affirms just the sense of why is this so beautiful? When you are just sweating up a storm and it looks like a tornado up there on stage. I crawl back up onto the stage and started pounding out the first song. There was blood on the keyboard.
Oh my God. Yeah, it chimes out more and more. I mean, I think you could break it down. The rhythmic aggression probably scans as intensity. While the actual tone that you're hearing is pretty, so I like that. I think that's a neat that's a neat thing about the instrument. And the reason that I play the way that I do is some to do with being a percussionist, but some of it is that I wanted to start bands sometimes when I was a kid. So people come over with a couple guitars and drums, and you couldn't hear the piano at all. It doesn't sing over that. They didn't have a PA system or anything like that. So I would play so hard to get the sound out and just to be heard just a little bit. And I think that really probably shaped my dynamic.
What won't you accept if you come upon a piano in a performance space and it just doesn't meet your requirements, aside from obviously it's got to be tuned?
Well, once... it was a piano, they told us it was a Steinway, and it was actually a piano that was called a Steinweg. And it was just a complete piece of crap. And I couldn't work with it at all. But, you know, when I was touring with my piano, when we were moving it ourselves, we wouldn't get attention to the piano like once a month. And so I would be breaking strings. I would have broken about 5 to 10 strings and playing a piano that was missing notes. All messed up, out of tune and everything. So I don't mind that. I think you can find something musical about it. I don't have a problem with most pianos.
Ever had one of your roadies or managers say to you, Ben, what about, you know, like a Yamaha synthesizer keyboard? It'd be much easier to put in the back of the car. We could take it up the stairs. Ever had that experience? And what did you say to them?
Well, no, I haven't, because I've been working with the same sound guy that we picked up very, very early in our career in New York at Brownies. It's a kind of a punk rock club. And we never, ever considered using electric piano. Really, the only reason I play one of those things is to sit in with Elton John, and that's about it. Everyone else, because we moved it ourselves. We moved the grand piano ourselves for about 3 years. Now, interestingly, I'm getting ready to go out with Y Music, who's a small, six-piece chamber group from Brooklyn. And I've decided to use an electric piano for that, which my sound man said, please don't do that. And I said, no, I would like to. And he goes, no, you're going to hate it. I'm telling you not to do it. We'll get you a real piano. But I've decided instead to go with electric piano. Just because I want everyone to be close together, and the piano is so large, is going to divide us. So I'm going to break my own law and probably upset a couple piano people.
Well, yeah, I hope it's not like, you know, Dylan at the Newport Folk Festival. You know, he showed up with electric guitar and everyone went, oh, my God, that's horrible.
Well, you know, I mean, in a way, I think, you know, these cymbals from the 60s when rock and roll was really busting at the seams like that, the Beatles and with Bob Dylan, I think those are things that have repeated themselves in smaller and bigger ways. And I think it's important to do that. It's important to say, well, this is who I am. This is what I do. And then one day to show up with the ukulele. I mean, that really does bum people out. It does bump people out, but it's also, you have to remember, it's like what we were all doing was in some way not as big as Bob Dylan, but was radical, and it was breaking the law in some way, and that's how you became you. So if you say, well, that was me that long ago, and I'm just going to keep breaking the law the same way, they've rewritten the laws. It's like it's time to do something different. It's always going to upset somebody.
Ben Folds, thanks so much.
Cheerio, mate. See ya.
Ben Folds joined us from his studio in Nashville, Tennessee, and there's lots more to that conversation. Ben just couldn't stop talking about his love for the piano. And our fan flames helped keep this going as well. I couldn't resist asking Ben about this song. Who was Kylie from Connecticut? The answer will really surprise you. And you can find it all and more on our Weekender podcast, something we started in 2014 to give you more takeaway stories, interviews, and behind-the-scenes looks at our show. It's available every Saturday at thetakeaway.org and via iTunes.
This is Rachel in Charlotte, and I'm one of those few people who still plays the piano. I went to college for it. I'm 26, and I've been playing for 20 years, and I'm currently a teacher. My favorite musical selection to play is the Brahms Rhapsody in G minor. Thanks.
Thanks for making our week there, Rachel. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.